We demystify what goes on behind the therapy room door. Join us on this voyage of discovery and co-creative conversations. This is the Therapy Show, Behind Closed Doors podcast with Bob Cook and Jackie Jones.
Welcome back to the Therapy Show, Behind Closed Doors. And we're up to, I'm looking on my list here, Bob, we're up to episode 148.
Now?
This one is 148. You sound shocked.
Yes, I mean, I was listening to the first ever Therapy Behind Closed Doors when we were introducing ourselves.
We were babies, Bob.
I was 70 and I'm 73 now. And we were talking about what we wanted to do. Well, what we wanted from the podcasts. And I enjoyed listening to that because you were talking about your history and also talking about your vision for the podcast, which I think we've achieved.
I was just about to ask you, have we achieved it? I need to go back and listen to what we said.
Yeah, it was talking about demystifying, or we were talking about our objectives of demystifying what was, you know, what happened in the therapy room. And I was talking about the importance of that. And you were talking about that as a major goal. I'm talking about the co-created nature of these podcasts, which, you know, stand us out, really.
Yeah, I think so. We're spreading far and wide, Bob, I think.
You were saying
said that they've listened to us.
Who said that?
When I do ice water therapy, so I go out and swim in, you know, ponds here, there,
be
and
careful,
everywhere.
Yeah,
and I'm always careful. I don't do it on my own. But yeah, I was talking to somebody and just happened to mention the pod, you know, that I do podcasts, and they listen to it. So there you go.
I know you said that you visited, I think, Spotify, which said that we've had 61,000 hits so far.
Yeah, more than that now. Yeah,
that's quite good. That's very good.
It is, absolutely, and it's all down to the listeners. Obviously, the content and the titles that you come up with help, Bob. So, talking about the titles, what we're going to be looking at this time is the pressure cooker effect in therapy. Another good one.
Yes, yes. What I meant by it is that when I was a kid growing up, my mother had this huge silver, massive pressure cooker. I don't know if you still buy them that way.
Yeah, with a lid that clicks shut. Yeah.
And of course, what happens with pressure cookers is that the pressure builds up, and then all of a sudden, it sort of goes.
Yeah.
If that's the right sound, anyway. And there's a cathartic release, well, perhaps not on the pressure cooker, but when I think of it in terms of psychotherapy. And I think psychotherapy is a bit like that.
Yeah.
When people first come to therapy, they don't really know what to expect, unless they've had some therapy before, and they still then don't know what to expect because they're usually at a different developmental phase. But they don't know what to expect, and so they're... defenses are usually quite stoic, if you like. They're usually testing the therapist out. They're usually quite wary of sharing their vulnerabilities.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's a different type of therapy right at the beginning. It's much more about listening to their story, being a witness to their story, helping them believe in us and getting their trust so they can actually start letting those defences down, which were so necessary years ago, but perhaps doesn't help in terms of where they want to go now.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of process, as they start to get to trust us and believe in the process of psychotherapy and the therapist in front of them, it's a bit like the beginning of a pressure, you know, pressure cooker effect.
Yeah.
That's the title.
Yeah. And for me, when I read this title, because I usually, you know, before we do it, have a quick think about what comes up for me with the titles that you've got, because I don't think we're always on the same wavelength sometimes. But for me, I was thinking about, you know, potential confrontation in the therapy process when we're challenging our clients, maybe.
Mm.
Because in the early days, when I first trained, I, hand on heart, can honestly say, I didn't challenge my clients at all. I was frightened to challenge my clients.
Oh.
Whereas now, I want to say pick them up on certain things. When I think they're people pleasing me or they're saying what they think they should say, I will challenge them and say, is that actually true? You know, when they say that they're okay, but the body language is telling me something completely different.
And what do you think that confrontation does, or is it aimed at?
Well, I'm very careful on when I do it. I wouldn't be confrontational at the early stages of therapy. I've already built up, you know, a therapeutic alliance, let's say, with my clients or whatever. But it's more about them being okay with their authentic feelings rather than the things that they think they should be doing or they should be saying. Mm. And a way of reflecting on things, maybe.
Mm. Mm. So are you also saying that, you know, with these sort of confrontation, which is a psychoanalytical term, I'm talking about positive confrontation here.
Absolutely, yeah.
Sort of adds to sort of pressure cooker effect.
I think so. Mm. That my understanding is, yeah, that sometimes, you know, emotions can build in the therapy session, and it's how, one, we acknowledge that and how we can release that through the therapy if there is something.
So in a way, you are tweaking their defense systems, aren't you?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I'm thinking, you know, this week in particular, I was seeing a couple who were saying very nice things, but the body language was saying that they were really frustrated with each other. So I kind of challenged that what they were saying and said, do you know what I mean? That I'm seeing some annoyance or aggravation in the body language. Is that what's going on? And it opened up a whole different area for us to discuss.
That's good. That's a very good way of looking at these things. And I often use, well, I used to use the term a lot in therapeutic practice when I talk to clients, specifically in groups. I actually use this analogy more. And I say, okay, so we can see what's going on here. And perhaps at a later time, we might get back to it and perhaps look at how, let's make something up, how you find difficulty expressing emotions, for example.
Yeah.
And as I think timing is key in psychotherapy, I might say something, okay, we'll come back at a later day and just allow your pressure cooker to just mull over.
Yeah. Yeah. Because so, it's a really good metaphor. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a smile about at the same time, because it's like, just by saying that, then, you know, it's ranking up the pressure in terms of how stoic are the defense systems.
Yeah.
It's another way of measuring their defense systems. And I'm only talking about, you know, in this case, you know, we're talking about 2024 defense systems. I'm not talking about so much when those defense systems were first originated, because they were originated for survival reasons.
Mm.
But we're now in, I don't know how many years later, where the defense systems perhaps are maybe stronger or even less stronger, and they need to break the habit,
yes,
or break the repetitive process, so they can integrate a new process or a new idea.
Yeah.
And they've almost forgotten how to allow themselves to be vulnerable and let those defense systems down, because they were built for survival purposes.
Yeah.
So there's no way that a therapist goes through the front door. You know, it's like they need to allow themselves to get to know the clients and XXX, and then the clients in their own time will start to allow themselves to be vulnerable or allow the pressure cooker to be released, if you
yeah. Yeah, and it doesn't need to all be done in one go. You know, on the pressure cooker, there is a little knob where we can just release a little bit of pressure over time. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My favourite sort of phrase is going to come out now, joking, which you've heard thousands and millions of times.
Oh, yes.
I do see it's a process and never an event. It's not just like we, you know, this is about really seeing therapy as a process.
Yeah. And, you know, you're using the analogy of the pressure cooker is kind of, you know, we can look at how our clients regulate their emotions or the intensity or, you know, strong feelings in the therapy room as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really good point there in terms of emotional regulation.
Yeah.
And if they've never been modeled or they haven't got appropriate emotional regulation, then their pressure cooker will just burst off or steam out really quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
In inappropriate ways. And I think it's a very common theme in psychotherapy where a person may come because they don't find it or they aren't able for whatever reasons to appropriately regulate their emotions.
Yeah.
It needs the therapist not only to model how to do that for the client, but also to look at what happened in the process where they weren't learnt or weren't able to regulate their emotions in an appropriate, healthy way.
Yeah, and it's an ideal opportunity to model that, do you know what I mean? Now we can do that. Yeah.
And of course, they're in charge of their own pressure cooker.
Yes.
It isn't the therapist is in charge of it.
No.
What the therapist does, in a way, is stoke that. In what you often, a technical word anyway for this, is called paradoxical interventions. You know what, in other words, in TA terms, in other words, would be to tweak the impasse.
Yeah.
So an impasse is where there's two opposing psychological forces. I don't want to do it. And another voice says, well, you better do it. I'm not going to do it. Well, yeah. So you've got two opposing voice forces. So somehow, if you can help the client go through this impasse or two stuck places, then their pressure cooker can often ease off.
Yeah. See, when you're talking about an impasse and things like that, I automatically think about the internal critic. Do you know what I mean? When we want to do something and there's that voice inside us that says, no, you can't do that, but you really want to do it. So there's, like you said, there's this internal dialogue that's going on all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So for a lot of people, they may have positive voices where in a healthy system. Yes. What you're talking about, and the clients we see often who have low self-esteem or might have a tendency for over depression or have a tendency for overthinking or be agitated, anxiety, and all these things where their self-agency is limited, what they often report is what you're saying here is an intensity of a critical narrative. In other words, there's part of themselves where they're saying, oh, gosh, I could have done it that way. I should have done it that way. How stupid I am. I X, 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 and X, you know, and it gets more intense and gets more intense. And they tell themselves off more and more, so they feel more anxious and they start overthinking and their self-esteem goes down. They think they've got no value. They feel worthless. They go to a dark place. They've got depression. And then this negative critical voice gets even more intense and more intense. And the pressure cooker builds up and builds up. And they have no way to regulate, stop.
Yeah.
You know, prick the intense, and often they go to a place of shut it off completely. They might go to a place of self-harm they might go to a place where they do extremely unhealthy things and attempt to stop that pressure cooker building up of these intense negative voices that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And in therapy, one of the methods, if you like, or a way of thinking about this, is to help the client ease off that pressure cooker in a healthy way, so they can start regulating, desensitizing, you know, the intensity of those voices, and prick that boil, which is growing and growing, and they feel powerless and lose self-agency.
Yeah.
And that's quite a long narrative, but that's how I see it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the important thing, is that they start to learn that they can control the response and the reaction. Yeah, that inner dialogue might still be there, but we don't need to listen to it. Do you know what I mean? That there are ways that we can understand what's going on.
Yeah, and usually, you know, Jack, at the beginning of this pressure cooker, I don't know if it's the beginning, but I'm going to, is that they lose sight or become they're unaware that that voice is someone else's.
Mm.
They feel it themselves.
Yeah.
And one of the big steps in psychotherapy, as you and I know, is to help the client be aware that it's not their voices. Those voices come from somewhere else. And that is such a crucial time in psychotherapy where they can take ownership of the voices.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think, you know, when I can remember lots of instances when I started talking with clients about the, you know, the internal dialogue and the voices that we hear and everything. And I always do a caveat on it that we all have that inner dialogue. It doesn't mean that we're schizophrenic. It doesn't mean that we've got a split personality. It's understanding exactly what you've just said. Whose voice is that and where does it come from? Yeah.
I remember once where I was doing therapy, and we were talking about, I think it was these voices she was hearing, or the negative things that she used to say about herself. And she went off to the toilet. Anyway, she'd been off quite a while. I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes. But I got a real concern that she hadn't come back in the time I thought was supposed to. So I went back. Anyway, went out the door and she was in the corridor banging her head against the wall.
Wow.
And when I, you know, got her to stop that and grounded her, she said, "I'm attempting to get rid of these voices, which I'm hearing all the time." So the pressure cooker had been building up and building up, and the parental voice is becoming stronger and stronger. And we need as therapists to help her deal with the, you know, desensitization of that pressure cooker and get to help them realize that it's not their narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's really valid and important, because then it's about them, you know, being able to self-regulate that and understand the process and, you know, be able to take the pressure off the pressure cooker themselves outside of therapy.
Yeah, that's
the outcome, that's the goal. Yeah.
I used to run 5-day what I call psychotherapy intensives back in the day. So people would come to my institute, would start at 9 o'clock till 6 o'clock, 5 days a week.
That's I mean,
they'd go home and come back.
Yeah.
And I used to use that phrase a lot because, you know, I could see the pressure building up with somebody. And I knew that if I tackled their defense systems or the voices that were building up or whatever was going on the first day, that it wouldn't be so as effective as perhaps 4 days later.
Yeah.
So another phrase I used to say was, okay, well, here what we've got, we're contracting here, and let's allow things to percolate and we'll see where we get to in 4 days' time, and we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
Timing.
I can see how that would work as well, because it, you know, that's a really good word for it, because when we're learning about these things do percolate. We do need to mull over them and explore things, and it's a new way of being, so it's not going to happen overnight. It's kind of, I often talk about osmosis, do you know what I mean? It kind of seeps in slowly sometimes.
That's right. Now, one level that I said earlier in the podcast, to say something else about this, at one level, they're in control of their own pressure cooker.
Yeah.
At another level, they're in therapy because they feel they're not in control of the process.
Yeah. Do you think people are always in control? They just don't know it.
That's a really good question. Of course, the way I was thinking about it was in terms of psychological time and real time.
Right. So,
in other words, we take back, if we think developmentally, and we go back to when they were younger, the power dynamics often in the family system or where they were so against them. In other words, the significant other people or the parents or the toxicity, it was very much one up, one down.
Yeah.
So they felt they had no power. You know, so it's like Hobson's choice. Which is it? It's like, if you're in a dangerous situation, where the power dynamics are so highly against you, you'll do whatever you can to survive. So at that level, maybe you have a choice. So you may switch off, you may dissociate, you might go crazy, you might do lots of things. So there, in that sense, they've got a choice. But the people in that level of trauma don't believe they have a choice.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So yes and no is my answer to that. And they come to therapy sort of 20 years later, 25 years later, and start talking about how they are today in their PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or whatever the symptoms are they come with. Even though I know the work is back in their history, doesn't matter where we start really. Well, it does. We have to start with their story in the present. They can only get to a place of being aware that they actually do have choice now. In the present day,
yeah,
by realizing what they didn't have all those years ago.
Yeah, yeah. I can remember when I was going through my training, and one of the reasons why I love transactional analysis and being a psychotherapist, because at the time I was fostering, and there was a lot of doom and gloom about fostering. Do you know what I mean? That the damage is done and they'll never get over it. And it was all, you know, write them off. They're never going to go to university. They're not going to amount, all this sort of stuff. And what transactional analysis and psychotherapy taught me was that we can go back and fill in the gaps. We can repair it. We can learn about all of this stuff. You know, and it doesn't necessarily have to impact us for the rest of our life, whatever trauma we've been through.
Yeah.
And that made me very hopeful.
What a wonderful way to put this. There's a wonderful book written by the originators of redecision psychotherapy from the transaction analysis movement. And they were Mary and Bob Goulding. And they wrote a book, they wrote several books, but they wrote a really fantastic book in 1973. Called The Powers in the Patient. Now, in American language, the patient is the client.
Right, yeah.
And firstly, often I think many therapists forget that. They may often think the power's in them, and it's not. It's actually in the client, in the patient, put it that way. And I think it's really important therapists remember that. And also on the same level, if we do this developmental work, they often don't feel they have any power.
Mm.
So It's important for therapists to remember that that's true. And a lot of the time, that is the therapy. In other words, they don't feel they have the power.
Yeah.
So the therapy is getting to a place where they can take back the power that perhaps they gave away, lost, or put in a very precious compartmental place in their psychological spirit, so they can be different today.
Yeah.
I would recommend that book every time. And through many of my clinical journeys, I remember that phrase, because sometimes, and I like to think it didn't happen that often, I could get carried away with my own ego.
Yeah.
But we don't have power. We make an impact.
Yeah.
We help people find their own power.
Yeah.
Alongside them and witness on their journey. And we help them take ownership of their own agency and self-power. However, in the end, it's the client that needs to take the power for the new decisions to reintegrate and to be able to discover their own self-agency. And we help them on the way.
Absolutely, yeah. I see it as we kind of shine a light on certain things that then they can explore and, like you say, integrate into their life or, yeah.
Now, of course, I don't want any of the therapist counselors who's listening to this podcast to think counselors and therapists don't do anything. They are pivotal in helping the client discover the power that perhaps they have put away or even forgot they had.
Yeah. I see, a big part of my job, rightly or wrongly, is to provide a safe space for people to explore this stuff, to put it bluntly. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. And to be in control of the pressure cooker.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm. And to feel safe knowing that they, I think for some clients, it can be really scary and they teeter on the edge of making a new decision or doing something different. And I think part of my job is to support them in stepping over into that, knowing that I've kind of got the back.
Yes, a very good phrase, that you've got their back.
Yeah. That it's okay, because it's a massive, it's a big thing, making changes in therapy. You know, when I think of me, 40 years or 40 plus years before I started doing my training, that there's a lot of stuff in there for me to be changing.
Yeah, and you've helped a lot of people. And there's another very good book written by the same person or people, Bob and Mary Goulding, After the Power and the Patient, I think, unless I've got it the wrong way around, 1974, called Redecision Psychotherapy. And they talk, I think it is the one after Power and the Patient, but they're talking there about how they help people take ownership of their own power to make new redecisions. And they couldn't do it, and they wouldn't be able to do it if they didn't feel they were in a safe, secure place to explore this, to be able to, with the therapist's help, find the power that often disavowed.
Yeah.
I think also the therapist needs to be more powerful than the toxic people in their head.
Yeah. I always remember that from my training. Is it protection, permission, and potency? Or permission, protect? Well, I don't know what order they come in, but yeah, that's always stuck in.
Yeah, because you'll repeat history with the client if you're not.
Yeah.
Just one of those thousands of other people who haven't been able to stand up to the negative, critical parents in their own heads.
Yeah. What an interesting topic, Bob.
Oh, yeah. I think we're talking about the real mechanics of effective psychotherapy here.
Yeah. And it all comes from that title about a pressure cooker, which I think is a brilliant metaphor for a lot of things that go on in everyday life.
Yeah, and, you know, from helping them understand they have a pressure cooker in the first place, and then helping them regulate the pressure cooker system, and then help them take ownership in a much more bigger way, they can then go, they're on the road to what I will call positive self-agency.
Yeah. Because I was thinking, you touched on group therapy before, and I, for some reason, I've no idea why, but I'm seeing an awful lot of couples at the moment. But the therapy room can be seen as a pressure cooker when you're dealing with more than one person, when there's couples. You know, they're both bringing the issues that they've got, and it can be quite a heated discussion that goes on sometimes.
Well, there's two people, often with interlocking scripts or opposing scripts, who trigger off their own internal pressure cookers or the others. And you imagine that multiplied by 8 people.
Yeah.
Many, many pressure cookers get triggered off. Group therapy is an extraordinarily powerful mechanism for effective psychotherapeutic change, as is couples therapy. So I'm glad you've got more couples, because I think there's not enough people who specialise in couples work and group work for whatever reasons. In early 90s, group psychotherapy in the UK was much more popular than it is now.
I've been toying with the idea, Bob. I shouldn't put this out there, but I have been toying with the idea purely and simply because I think a lot of people struggle and can't afford individual therapy, and it's That's a way right. of them accessing lower yeah. cost when they're in a group. So I have been toying with the idea.
If you do
Maybe
it,
we need to have a discussion about it.
Please do. And if you do it, make sure they've spent a bit of time in individual therapy with you first. Otherwise, you'll lose them.
Yes.
But I do think it's a very effective type of therapy, group therapy, and all these pressure cookers can often get triggered off. And that's when the therapist can help the client not only be aware of the pressure cookers that have been triggered off, but also what triggers the pressure cookers, and hopefully eventually not only do they regulate their own pressure cookers, but they can actually take charge of that process and develop a new, healthy, integrated process.
Yeah. Because just to finish up on this topic, as you were talking then, I was thinking, you know, that you've got a room of 8 people and they've all got their pressure cookers. Everybody's life up to this point is unique and individual to them.
Yeah.
But do you think that from our point of view, there's lots of similarities in what people go through in their upbringing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we know this. So I was just thinking of articles people will know, like the 8 stages of men, the Eric Erickson's developmental articles where they talk about people going through similar stages, you know. And you know yourself from that wonderful book that you quote by, you know,
Pam Levin.
Yeah, Pam Levin, The Cycles of Power.
Yes, yeah.
So definitely we do. Freud used to talk about different developmental stages.
Yeah.
I take it as read. I think we have similarities that we go through different psychological stages, that if they have been missed out or there's been a fixation or there's been trauma, then that obviously may result in challenging consequences later.
Yeah.
So I think by definition. And then I think about, and I need another podcast for this, but you know, when we're born, from the day we're born, you know, I think there's an element of trauma.
Yeah.
So
there's certainly trauma from the point of giving birth, so they must be on the other side of it.
This wonderful womb, which is very secure and safe, hopefully being wrenched out or coming out to this very different world, can be seen as traumatic.
Absolutely.
And, you know, from the very beginning of psychological life, I think there can be challenges of trauma. And if they aren't dealt with in a healthy way, then consequences could be psychologically may be difficult later on.
Mm.
So, yes, I think there are similar thematic developmental problems, traumas that people may occur.
Yeah.
And how we deal with them are often, well, there are unique, our own unique experiences, aren't there?
Absolutely. I think that's where the uniqueness comes in, is the decisions that we make around those things and how we're going to be in the world.
Developmental
processes.
I mean, Richard Erskine, another mentor of mine and the chair, or past chair anyway, he certainly was the founder of the International Integrative Psychotherapy Association. He wrote a whole series of articles around what he called relational needs or unmet relational needs, and permissions that need to be given almost universally by the therapists to enable the clients, if you like, to deal with these unmet needs and the developmental deficits that have occurred. But in that, how the client experiences and defends against the developmental deficits are unique.
Yes. Yeah. I've really enjoyed that, Bob. Thank you very much.
Does that make sense, that last bit?
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's really important for therapists, because if therapists just think, well, I've read this article, I've done all this, like I can do this, a bit like chess, like I was talking about in the last podcast, then X will happen. Well, that's one way of looking at it, and I talked about it in the last podcast. Another way, and a much more important, I think we need to see the clients have their own unique experiences, attune to those unique experiences, and go with that in terms of potency, permissions, and everything else. Because in another process altogether, it's not like chess.
Yeah.
I'm a great fan of relational psychotherapy. So another way to call my work, in a way, is relationally developmental in nature for effective psychotherapy.
Yeah.
That's a mouthful, isn't it?
It certainly is, but it's a good title to have, Bob. I like that one.
And I know you're very relational in your developmental work.
I am. I do like, do you know what I mean, looking at things relationally. And one of the relational needs that always sticks with me is the need for the other to initiate.
Yes. That's so interesting and important.
And I don't know whether that's because I need that's the one that I kind of hone in on a lot of the time. But I think it is really important, even in the therapy room, for me to initiate contact with the clients.
Yeah. 100% more. And another relational need that you home in a lot in, so I just want to say that as I'm sitting on these podcasts, is the relational need for safety and security.
Yes. Yeah.
And you're right. They represent our history.
Yeah. It's all interesting stuff, this, isn't it, Bob?
Yes, and unfortunately, I know we've got to stop. That's a hint of Pops going over time, but such a wonderful podcast, this, I think.
Yeah. From a wonderful title, we've covered all sorts of stuff. We've been all the way there and back again. So what we're going to be looking at next time, which again is another wonderful title, is 5 things I wish I'd known before I became a psychotherapist.
When I came to this title, Jackie, I thought the first title was 10 things.
I'm sure we'll come up with 20 things, Bob.
But I thought if we have 10, we'll be here. It'll go way over time in the podcast. So I've cut it back to 5. And now I'm thinking, talking to you, perhaps I wish I'd kept it to 10. But I'm looking forward to that.
Me too. We'll see how many we come up with. I'll keep counting. Until next time, Bob. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Therapy Show, Behind Closed Doors podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. We'll be back next week with another episode.